Okay, thank you, and let me, I think I'm gonna handle this by talking about three or four topics, bouncing off some of the Jewish thinking and practical topics. Most of my secular career was actually focused on trauma. I was very involved in various research projects and clinical projects over the 25 years that I was hospital-based and medical school-based in working with traumatized populations. So I spent time in Sri Lanka after the tsunami, in Israel after many terror attacks, in the Gulf after hurricanes. I've done a lot of work, mostly in the area tied to surviving traumatic events or unfortunately losing people who one may be very close to. So I'm going to bounce off some ideas, since the whole focus here is Jewish thinking in these areas. And I'm going to start with a practical question that I've been asked many times, and I'm going to address it with a Rav Yeruchim Lubavitch's insights. I'm starting here just sort of to show you how the deep psychological insights that Jewish thinking brings to death, dying, to suffering, in many ways are deeper than what psychology brings. So here's the story that I'm often asked, question I'm often asked. I'll go to a High Lifeline retreat, and I'll be asked by parents, they'll say, you know, my child had cancer when he was an infant, and he finished active treatment by age 2. He has absolutely no memory of having been treated for leukemia, let's say. Do I tell him or do I tell her that she once had cancer? There's no reason for her to ever know. Why would I put that cloud over her life? Or an even more common question will be parents who come to me and say, you know, we have a family of 4 children, but the kids don't know that before they were born, there was another sibling who died of SIDS, let's say, who died a sudden death in an accident. Is there any reason to tell them? Why tell them that something like this could happen? Again, why cloud their life and their sense of safety with this horrific knowledge that they have a sibling who died before they were born? And a very common question that I've been asked is, what happens if somebody is the child of a survivor? I'll tell it with a vignette. A good friend of mine was sitting next to me in Shul on Yom Kippur. And I knew he was an only child. I knew both his parents were survivors. And he takes out a sheet of paper with 9 names on it, which made no sense to me, because even though both of his parents had recently died, there were many more names than made sense to me for him to say Yisker for. So I asked him what it was. He said, I never knew this, but before my parents died, they each told me that I have to say Yisker for these 7 half-siblings who I never knew I had. They didn't want to burden me with it, but they both were married before. Their wives and husband were killed in the camps, as were all their children, and they want somebody to say Yisker now for their slaughtered children. And before they died, they gave me this list. And the question is, can you argue, in thinking about the psychology of death or dying, that, in fact, why tell? What's the point of telling? Or could you argue that honesty makes the most sense, that younger siblings have the right to know that they have to say Kaddish once a year for a brother or sister they never knew? Or that somebody who's second generation should tell the third generation, and themselves should commemorate the loss of siblings, half-siblings, who they never knew? Or, if a child herself was sick, should that be part of their narratives? Listen to this brilliant insight from Rav Yeruchim Levavitz, the Mashgiach of Mir in pre-Holocaust Europe. There's a very cryptic pasuk at the end of Mishpatim. It's talking about God's footstool. And it describes God's footstool as being Kamase Livnas Hasaper, that it's basically made out of sapphire, and embedded in the sapphire is a brick. And Rashi says the brick is Zecher L'Shibud Mitzrayim. It's whatever memory means in the context of God. It's an eternal reminder of our suffering during slavery in Egypt. So Rav Yeruchim very obviously asks, Ma inyan hashibud la'achar ha'geula? Why is there any need for a remembrance of the brick when we were freed from Egypt millennia ago? What's the point? There must be something deeper in this. And he answers in a way that'll answer the three clinical questions I just asked you. He says, because very often in life, we've been through tough times. We might have lost a parent, we might have lost a grandparent, we might have a history like the one I just told you about, where we were very sick but never knew about it, or in the case of a second generation where survivors didn't even know that they had a previous history, their children, of having lost half siblings or siblings. And he says it's very tempting that when things are better and life is going well and life is filled with the light of sapphire, to remember only the sapphire and to say, why cloud up my memory or the memory of my family with the memories of the brick, with the memories of suffering? And like the excellent psychologist he always was, Rav Yeruchim Levavitz says, it's to teach us an extremely important lesson in life. That if we've gone through tough times, it might have been suffering in some way with a serious illness, it might have been having parents who went through a messy divorce, it might have been any of the ongoing suffering that sometimes life is about. As Ramchal says, part of life is lamod benisyonos. He says, if we went through the brick at any point in our life, and now it's long gone, and there's no reason to really remember the lesson of the brick, and life is now all sapphire, he says, it's to teach us that we always have to integrate the lesson of the brick, the lesson of the suffering, even in times of light. It's a brilliant, brilliant insight. And it's so true. It's exactly what psychologists would tell you in talking about the psychology of loss and the psychology of bereavement. Sure, we go on and the new normal takes over. And even though things seem incredibly tragic and incredibly grim years and years later, and the suffering with having a child with cancer gives way to the yeshua of having a child who's now healthy, or the loss of a firstborn child gives way to the joy of 4, 5, 6 new children, however many children who never knew about this child. And it becomes very tempting to say, it's in the past, let's put past suffering behind us. And what Rav Yeruchim brilliantly said, as the Holocaust was gathering around his community and around his Talmidim, what he brilliantly says is, no, you have to remember it, you have to integrate it. So if a child had cancer and was treated till age 2 and now has no memory of it, you tell her. Because she has to know that this is part of her life's narrative. If an older child had a history of, if younger children had an older brother or sister who died who they never knew about it, you have to show the picture of that child. You have to let them know about the previous history and the previous suffering. And this is something that comes up all the time. And again, I find it's interesting because in the psychological research on this, it says the obvious. It says what we know, which is that honesty is usually best. Otherwise, it's impossible to keep a secret from somebody because somehow it'll be conveyed to them. Either the body will keep the score or somehow there's going to be some kind of a subtle message given over. And I'll just end this section with a pretty mystical sounding story. It's a true story but it's a story about the power, the negative power of secrecy, and that'll end the end of part one here. Listen to this story. I was giving a talk at a post-traumatic stress disorder conference, and I was one speaker, and the other speaker was a well-known psychiatrist. And he gets up, and he talks about the following patient that he had. He said he had a patient who presented with a chronic motor tic. You know that sometimes people have Tourette's, so they have a waxing and waning course. You may have an eye twitch and a vocal tic, and then it may go to a different part of the body. A chronic motor tic is very different. It doesn't have a waxing and waning course. It's chronic. In this case of this man, he had a very painful neck tic. So he'd look like this, turning to his left, and it caused, and it was chronic. He was often like that, and it caused some terrible neck pain in the back left part of his neck. And he went to neurologists, he went to all kinds of specialists, orthopedists, and they couldn't find any medical or neurologic reason for the chronic motor tic. And they couldn't figure it out, so finally they said, look, you know, we think this might be partly psychological. We're going to recommend you to a psychiatrist who specializes in these areas. So he goes to the psychiatrist, who gives him a checkup, and says, you know, there are very few normal people I've ever seen in my practice, but you're a totally normal guy. There's nothing wrong with you. I used to have a professor who would say there are two kinds of people. There are normal people, and there are people I know. Okay, once you get to know somebody, you usually find some strangeness in them. But this guy got a clean bill of health. So the psychiatrist said, look, he said, I really think that whatever's going on with you is purely medical. There's no psychological component to it. But there's one thing I'm not certain about. I know you mentioned to me that your father was a Holocaust survivor and that he never talked to you about it, never talked to you about his experiences during those years. He said, I don't think it's tied to your motor tic, but why don't you go and talk to your father and ask him if he could shed any light on your symptoms. Now, it turns out the father was in a retirement home in Florida. So this man hops on a plane, goes down to Florida, and tells his father about his medical condition and how he's in chronic pain because of it. And he says, Dad, I'm so sorry to even bother you with this. It's just that the doctor felt that, you know, he wanted to be certain that there's no reason whatsoever that would explain my symptoms from a psychological standpoint. And his father starts to cry. And he says, I thought I could shelter you from this. He said, it's clear to me I couldn't. He said, on the horrible day that I was taken to the concentration camp, I never wanted to tell you, I wanted to spare you the pain, that I had an earlier wife and you had a number of half-brothers and sisters. And as my first wife and your half-siblings were selected to go to the left, to go to their deaths, the last time I saw them, I was looking back, as far back as I could to see them, little knowing that I never see them again. And a capo came and beat me unconscious, and when I came to, it became clear that I was chosen to go to the work camp, and I never saw them again. He said, I thought, why should I tell you this horrible piece of your history? Why should you live in the shadow of such pain and such loss? And now that I see what's happening, your neck tic looks exactly like the position I took on that horrible day when I lost your half-siblings and my first wife. Now, you could hear this. It may sound bizarre to you. Any mental health people here know that the body keeps the score, and there are all kinds of subtle nonverbal ways that we convey sense memories to people who we're close to. I won't go into the details of it, but it's interesting. He went back, talked to this psychiatrist about what his father told him, and by naming the monster, he was able to somehow get control over it, give words to the pain, and the tic went away. Now, this may sound a little off, especially to those of you who aren't in mental health, but it's just an example of the power of some of the wisdom in Jewish thinking. And that leads me to the second point I want to make. And it goes like this. I was working on the DSM-IV post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis with a team. I was on the committee that helped develop that diagnosis, you know, that psychiatric diagnosis, and I was privileged to work with a world-renowned expert in trauma from Boston, psychiatrist from Boston. We were working on a paper, and he showed me the picture of a brain of one of his patients. It was the fMRI of a patient he had who was stuck in the stairwell of the World Trade Center on 9/11, certain he was going to die. And my friend, who's a little bit of a meshuggah la'osa diver when it comes to trauma, induces a flashback. This is part of the therapy. And you'll hear this has a happy ending. It wasn't an exploitative thing. But he shows me a picture of his patient's brain as his patient is having a flashback to the worst moment of his life. So what do you think the brain looks like when you're reliving? He was reliving the moment that he thought he was about to die trying to escape the World Trade Center. And he shows it to me. It's an amazing thing to see. What he shows me is when you look at what the brain looks like at the worst moment of its life, it's in a state of demimut, of total speechlessness, meaning Broca's area, the language centers of the brain, was totally shut down on the fMRI. The Barbanel brilliantly says, why when Aaron hears about the horrible news about his two sons dying, why doesn't it say Vayishkod Aaron? Why does it say Vayidom Aaron? So he answers, because Sheket is for when you're not literally rendered speechless. You sort of have answers. You have words, but you choose not to share the words. Demimut is for when you're literally rendered speechless. You're literally beyond words. But then what Dr. van der Kolk showed me is that as he gave his patient words for his pain, as he helped him integrate the meaning of what happened to him, and as he helped him name the monster and lit up Broca's area, that's when his patient recovered from the post-traumatic stress symptoms that came on that horrible day on 9/11. You know, it's interesting. Rabbi Charlap, the grandfather of Rav Charlap from Rietz, has a Haggadah called May Morom. And this was over 100 years ago. Well, or maybe about 100 years ago. He wrote the following. He said, slavery, avdus, takes away our koach hadibur. Slavery takes away our power of speech. And what's magid? Magid is our answer to that demimut. It's our answer to that silence. As we will sit 4 weeks from, what was it, last night? Or two nights ago? In about 4 weeks from now, as we sit around the table with our family, with our parents, with grandparents, and with the next generation possibly, okay? And we say magid, that's our answer to slavery. Because the opposite of slavery takes away our koach hadibur, is to light up Broca's area, it's to talk, it's to give words for the pain. So that's the second point I wanted to make to you. So part one was talking about the imagery of integrating the lesson of the sapphire, even in times of, I'm sorry, the lesson of the brick, even in times of light. And point two is to talk about the importance of words, the importance of the narrative, the importance of naming the monster as a way of recovering. Okay? So that's 2 points. Before I move on, let me take questions, thoughts, comments. I saw somebody had wanted to ask something before. Did you want to ask something? That was, no? You're okay? Yeah, please.
I know you didn't want to get into it, but is it possible to answer quickly, why is it that what his father, maybe I misunderstood, but why is it that what his father experienced before he was even alive affected him physiologically?
Because the answer is I don't know, but that we do convey all kinds of lessons to the next generation non-verbally. I personally don't understand it. I spoke to some trauma experts who specialize in that kind of treatment. They said, yes, yeah, so what else is there? They deal with that all the time. It's not normal. I mean, it was like if you deal with trauma, yeah. To them, it was a totally understandable kind of set of symptoms.
So perhaps it, like, translated into the father's behavior?
Yeah, in some way. In some behavioral way. I'm not saying it was a mystical thing. In some behavioral way, he may have shaped that kind of, you know, sort of transmitted it. I have other stories like that. They sound a little creepy because they're almost mystical. But then when you do, it's my colleague says the body keeps the score. Different things. I don't know. When I was growing up, there was, this is just like a simple example. There was a woman who, in a wonderful marriage to a wonderful man in my community, who had eye cancer, and she had to have surgery on her eye, and you know, had this huge patch over her right eye. Within, I don't know, a month of her surgery, her husband developed a Bell's palsy that led to a paralysis of exactly the same area, and he had, so they looked like matching bookends, totally unconsciously, totally somehow along these lines. And I could think of other examples of how the body keeps the score. You know, there's a whole field of psychoneuroimmunology. It's called psychoneuroimmunology, where we look at the interface between psychology, neurology, and our immune system. And it's fascinating because now we're beginning to understand it a little better, and there's some interventions that are made. By the way, maybe that'll lead me to my next point, just about some of the wisdom of Chazal, but let me hear from you first.
I just wanted to know if you had any suggestions for what the Holocaust survivors or any of these trauma people who are affected by it, like their children or their grandchildren, can do to ensure that it isn't passed on to future generations.
Right. So the question is what do we, what, first of all, according to the first point I made, you want it passed on, but you want it passed on to future generations in a way that there's meaning, in a way that there's understanding. And probably the most obvious kind of answer is meaning making, is to go, and maybe I'll go to that now, but let me just make a note so I don't forget about this other thing. We'll talk about it in a minute. So it goes like this. When survivors, by the way, very often survivors did not talk about their suffering at the beginning, and that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. As a matter of fact, in Israel, where people were actively discouraged sometimes from talking about their experiences, and instead they threw themselves into rebuilding the country and into fighting in wars, it turns out that even though objectively survivors who moved to Israel should have done worse because they never had peace, and you would think it would re-traumatize them, actually, psychologically, in the cross-cultural studies, survivors who moved to Israel did better psychologically long-term than survivors who went to other parts of the world. Because anything that takes you from active to passive and gives you meaning, you'll do better. So in terms of suffering and in terms of meaning-making, probably the best antidote of transforming the suffering of the Holocaust and the next generation to something that's an active, actively growth-inducing thing is to figure out a way to talk about it and find meaning from it. And again, I'll talk to you about the beautiful Medrash Tehillim that I'm sure some of you have heard. It's brought down by Rabbeinu Yonah, which I think is magnificent. It's probably one of the nicest ways I know of to answer your question. Here's what it says. It says, Ilu nafalti lo kamti. Ilu yashafti bachoshech lo haya arli. Think about it. It's magnificent. If I never fell down, I never would have gotten up. If I never sat in darkness, I never would have appreciated the light. And when you have a survivor who has a very deep understanding of that concept and is able to transmit it to the next generation in an integrated, open way, and to see themselves as not stuck, but as positioned. Again, Rasel Vaychik would talk about, you always have a choice in going through some of the tough times in life between being in a yield position or a go-roll position, right? I'm sure you've learned this at some point. A go-roll position is where you feel like you're a log on the river at the mercy of the current. A yield position is when you see that this is my destiny. This is my destiny. My destiny is I'm a grandchild of a survivor. And this means that I'm going to be much more mindful about my mission in life and my responsibility. So you don't feel burdened by it, but you feel challenged by it. Psychologically, anytime you go from threat to challenge, from yield, from goal to yield, instead of it being something that weighs you down, it's something that transforms the nisayon into a nace, right? Or the masa, the burden, into a masa. Masa also means a song, a nevuah, right? In Ach, we see that a number of times, that a masa is a nevuah or a song. So it's all how you see it. Let me give you the example of a magnificent, magnificent parable from the Duvna Magid, which answers your question in a way that makes a lot of sense to me anyway. He talks about the jewel and the crown. Okay? And this is a parable I found myself using over and over again. For example, when I was working with widows or orphans who lost family in 9/11, or when I was in Israel after a pigua. I'll just go over with you what this beautiful thought is from the Duvna Magid. He says you have a king, and the king's an insecure king, and he has a big crown, and in the center of the crown there's a diamond that's bigger than the Hope Diamond. And he's an insecure guy, and he gets pleasure from having the biggest and best in the land. Okay, makes him feel good about himself. One day he wakes up. He has on his nightstand his crown. It's the first thing he looks at to put on. And he takes his crown, and he's about to put it on, and he sees a flaw has developed right down the center of the diamond. And he's spooked. He puts out a call to the entire kingdom that anybody who could fix this flaw, I'll make wealthier than anybody else. I'll make them wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. And jewelers come from all over the world to fix the flaw. Can't fix the flaw. It's the flaw in a diamond. It's the flaw in the diamond. It can't be fixed. So a little old Jewish jeweler comes in. There has to be a Jew as the hero of a Duvna Magid's parable. And he takes an engraving tool, and he engraves magnificent leaves around the flaw, which now becomes the trunk of a tree that makes the diamond even more beautiful than it was before. Amazing, amazing thought. Okay, you can't, if you're the grandchild of a survivor, can't undo the flaw. But the flaw could become the cornerstone of something even greater than those who don't descend from survivors. Okay, it's growth inducing. And I'll tell you a story. Yeah, sure.
But wouldn't the friend or the survivor be different than if someone died? And it's not like the survivor is a positive thing, they survive. I'm saying it's different than someone
does. Right. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I was responding to her question about survivors, right? But you know what's interesting? So that's an excellent question. Let me answer that question with a personal experience I had. Okay, with something more less clearly applicable than the Holocaust. I did a study many years ago with some colleagues. I designed, I had a grant to look at 5 different parts of the country to look at the impact of having a child with cancer. And I put together a whole research protocol. I was pretty proud of it. I thought it was interesting. It was pretty early in my career. It was a long time ago. And almost immediately, my research assistants around the country started calling me to yell at me. They said, everybody's furious at you. They're just angry. You have to change your research. So I said, what are you talking about? They said, well, you didn't ask a single question about what came from the family from having a child with cancer. So I said, I can't have questions like that. That would be the height of chutzpah. How could I possibly do that? They said, look, we're just the messenger. It's not our thought. They just say they're angry. So I added a couple of questions reluctantly and nervously about what good came from going through such horrific, horrific kind of experience as having a child facing a serious illness. Now, I'll just share with you one answer. There was a woman who, before her 15-year-old son was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, she said the most important thing in her life was perfecting her tennis serve. And it was a stormy night when her son was on active treatment in the hospital. Her husband was spending the night in the hospital to be with their son. And she's getting ready to go at 7 a.m. to the hospital to spell her husband and to spend the day with her son. And before she could get into her car, her doorbell rings. And it's her next door neighbor who's crying hysterically. It's like inconsolable. There was a storm in the middle of the night, and there was a tree between her house and her neighbor's house. And the tree was blown down, her neighbor's car was in the driveway, and the car was totaled. And the neighbor was like beyond consolation. So she called her in. Together they called the insurance company. She gave her neighbor a lift to her job, to her neighbor's job. And as she turned the car around to go to the hospital, she started laughing to herself because she thought, this is what she writes, she thought, what would have happened if the wind was blowing in the opposite direction? What would have happened if last night the tree fell on my car and my car was totaled? You know what I would have done? She writes, I would have called a cab, and maybe in a couple of weeks I would have gotten around to having the insurance adjuster come. She says, I know what's important now in life. What's important is to give my husband a break. What's important is to be at my son's bedside. She says, I have a whole different view of what matters in life. She said, that's the gift given to me by going through this horrible time. Again, it's the shift from Goral to Yid. Now, it's not easy. Meaning making shifts for different people, it's going to be different things. And it's often quite a journey till they find the right part of meaning making. I'll tell you something I always tell the Smicha students that I learned. I've been volunteering to be the psychologist in residence of the High Lifeline retreat since they started over 20 years ago. So I'll tell you what happened just this last retreat, and it's picking up on conversations I've had over the last 20, 21 years with parents. And it goes like this. There's a medrash that says, this is about the meaning making part. And by the way, I could talk to you guys probably for the next 10 hours and only touch the beginning of the surface of the wisdom. So I'm just giving you the points that come to mind and just touching the beginning of the beginning of the surface. So here's the Medrash. Medrash says, well, I'll start with a story. A man comes to me. Well, I have to start with the Medrash. You can look it up. It's Hashem Tzadik Yivchan. The pasuk says, God tests tzadikim. And the Medrash compares that process. It has two kinds of sets of imagery for that process. One is to a barrel, okay? That a barrel maker, before he makes the barrels, hits the barrels hard. And only the soundest barrels make it to the barrel making process. So it's through the hitting, the barrel becomes sounder, and only the good barrels make it. So according to that, if you're going through the torture of having a sick child, it's because Hashem knows you're a tzaddik and you can handle it. So that's one imagery. And the other is flax. That in the process of making flax, the flax gets beaten. And according to that imagery, it's going through tough times makes you stronger. So in one case, it's only the fittest people get chosen. Only tzaddikim get chosen of your sufferings because you're a tzaddik. In the other case, it's flax. It's you're strengthened by the process, like the story of the woman in the tree. How many of you would prefer to be flax over the barrel? I'll ask it differently. How many of you would prefer, how many of you would be comforted if you're going through a tough time by being the barrel, by being compared to a tzaddik? Anybody here would like to be the barrel? It's interesting. And how many of you would prefer to be flax to the barrel? Okay. So what I usually get, like when I say this to the smicha guys, the overwhelming majority of smicha guys prefer flax to barrel. The overwhelming majority of people in general, about 90%, I would say roughly, prefer to be flax to the barrel. Because what they'll say is, at the Chai Lifeline Retreat, they get furious if somebody says that you're a tzaddik. They say, my son or my daughter should suffer because I'm such a tzaddik. They get furious. So there was a man at the last retreat who was so angry, he was crying, not out of sadness, he was crying out of rage. He's saying, could you believe it? Somebody told me that Hashem tzaddik yivchon, if this is happening, it's because I'm a tzaddik. And he was, not only did it not comfort him, it got him furious. But then he said, the weirdest thing is, my wife was comforted by it. So the very thing that comforted the wife, she liked being the barrel, is the very thing that he found to be infuriating. So the answer here is, and there's a take-home message here, I'm not just saying this theoretically, you never know what's going to be comforting for somebody who's going through avelos. Sometimes the very one thing that you could say to somebody that'll be the single most helpful thing they hear from anybody will be the worst thing you could say to somebody else. And the only way to know what's going to be helpful is what psychologists call metacommunication, which is to communicate about communication. Communicate about communication, meaning to ask people. You ask people, hey, what's the deal here? What do you find to be helpful? You don't ask them barrel or flax, although I do that sometimes. I'll talk about both parts. Okay, let me, I know that I'm running out of time here. Yeah, please.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know, I'm assuming this, but I just want to clarify. If they had other siblings that, or parents that passed away, then they could say something. But what if it's their grandparent, or what if it's, okay, for instance, my dad passed away, so and now I have a new, I have a stepdad, so can I just pretend that, my stepdad's my dad to my kid, in Rosh Hashanah, when I get married and have kids, or, should I say, there was, you had another grandfather, but he passed away, and now this is your new grandfather.
Right, right. I mean, my vote would be strongly to say, yeah, you tell them the whole story. You tell them the whole story. Because first of all, your father deserves it, your original father deserves it, and they need to know about him, and they need to know about what he was, and what you heard about him, or what you experienced with him. And that doesn't in any way diminish their understanding and their appreciation for your stepfather. You know, so in general, that's an excellent question. That's exactly the opening point I had, is you need to have the brick alongside the sapphire.
But even for grandparents or
absolutely. Absolutely. It's important. It's important to know about. It's important to know and understand, and even though it's a few generations down the road. Okay, let me end with a more maybe hopeful kind of story, and then if you want to continue some questions, I know there's another talk coming around now. So let me share with you again. Like I said, I could go on forever here. I think I'm going to share with you probably it's the one of the major points I didn't make, and that's that coping comes in many different flavors. Some people cope with distraction. Other people cope by talking. Other people cope with music. Other people cope with art. And what all the research shows is that, my guess is, if I went around the room with you and I asked you, ma'at min ha'or docha harbe min ha'choshech, little sparks of light push away a lot of darkness, what's your spark of light that gets you through tough times? And it's usually not one thing, it's usually a bunch of things. But you have people who mainly are helped with physical exercise, other people who are mainly helped with art, other people who are mainly helped with talking, other people need to distract. And there's no one right way. What the research shows is you have to build up your own toolbox of coping mechanisms. So I'm going to end with a story just to sort of hammer home this point, which was best explained by Rashamshin Rafal Hirsch, who says that the vowelization of Kaylee Kaylee Lama Azavtani is wrong. He says we should read it Kaylee Kaylee Lama Azavtani. It's not why, it's what. Again, this week's Parsha, we will read about Moshe going and being shown the back of Hashem. So Moshe be asking, in a way, the question of theodicy. How could it be tzaddik v'ralo? And even Moshe is only shown the back. Even Moshe isn't told the why. He's only shown indirectly what's behind what happens. Because we can never know. Why is quicksand? What? How you're going to cope with it? How you're going to find meaning is the ultimate answer. So let me end with a story, and with this I'll let you guys go. Okay? At the height of the Second Intifada, I was invited to Israel to speak to a group of trauma therapists. Not because they don't know much more about trauma than I ever will, but they sometimes, even if you're an expert in something, you can't think clearly when you're in the middle of it. They needed an outsider. So one morning, I think it was, I was giving a talk to about 40 therapists at the Jerusalem Trauma Center. And in the middle of the talk, the phone rings in the director's office, and it was this horrible news that there was, in the Hebrew University cafeteria, the Frank Sinatra cafeteria, there was a pigua, there was a bombing, and 9 people were killed, 7 of them Americans. I believe this was in 2002. And immediately, all the therapists were called out to go to different parts of the country. In Israel, everybody knows everybody else. This was 9 deaths. Immediately, they were all called out. Pretty much, I was left alone with the director and assistant director of the Jerusalem Trauma Center. And the phone rings again. And it was news that there was a summer camp in the middle of Israel where a counselor in the camp had been killed. And they were out of therapists. You know, they didn't have anybody to send. So the director of the Jerusalem Trauma Center asked if I would go. You know, then he was able to send the assistant director, Dr. Ruth Padarenzik, a wondrous, she's since become a world-renowned trauma expert. So we both went to the camp. We were supposed to spend the day with the kids. We were supposed to tell them the news about the horrible loss of their counselor. But that's not what happens in Israel. In Israel, they're certainly not going to let an American tell them what to do. We get to the camp. Immediately, the director puts me and my colleague in the corner, gets up, and tells the kids the horrible news. And he says something that I'll never forget. It's exactly what Rav Hirsch says. It's not Lama, it's Lama. He says, I have 5 coping rooms for you. One room, go and write letters to the parents of your madricha about what a wonderful woman she was. The other room is a music room. Go in and express yourselves musically. The other room is an art room. Express yourselves artistically. The other room is a tefillah room. And the other room was a talking room where I was supposed to, together with my colleague, talk to the kids. So it's 5 rooms. Writing, art, music, davening, and talking. The kids were told they could go from room to room throughout the day, but not a single kid switched rooms. The talkers talked, quarter of the kids talked and spent the day with us talking. The music kids did music. The only room not picked was the davening room. It was probably too soon for davening. Right? They were in a psychological state of aninut. You're not allowed to daven when you're an onen, okay, before the kfura. And even though this wasn't a family member, they were probably feeling that way. And it was exactly a quarter, and nobody switched. And I was very, very touched by this. And I learned a lot from this. So I go back to New York the next week, and there was a, if I remember correctly, it was the first anniversary of 9/11. I was asked to give a talk. And I started by talking about what I learned from the 5 coping rooms in Israel just a short time before. And a woman comes over to me after my talk, and she says the following story, which is the way I'll leave you, because it's, I think, a story of hope and of tremendous wisdom. She said her father was Elie Wiesel's bunkmate in the concentration camp. You know the famous picture of Elie Wiesel sticking his head out. Actually, one of the men was my best friend's father growing up, who used to tell me all kinds of stories about what it was like to be there. But the other teenager sticking his head out was her father, who was a vision sechassid. And she said Professor Wiesel had given a talk the week before here in Manhattan, and her father heard she was going to the talk. He said, you know, I don't know if he'll even remember me, but just in case, give him regards. So she waits online after the talk. She goes over to Professor Wiesel and says, you know, my father's name is so-and-so. He's not sure if you'll remember him, but he wants to give regards. Immediately, tears come to Elie Wiesel's eyes. He says, are you kidding? He never told you that anything I accomplished is because of him, that he saved my life? She said, no, never. What are you talking about? He says the following unbelievable story that I think, in a way, is another part of the meaning-making, but certainly is the way of bringing home the multiplicity of coping. He said there was a day that was horrible even by concentration camp standards. They were being tortured. They were being, you know, starved. They were, we all know what happened there. At least intellectually, we know what happened there. And a group of Russian prisoners of war got a hold of some rat poison. And they went online, the Russians. They took a dose of rat poison and they laid down to die. Adolescence is a time that suicide is very, very contagious. So they decided, all of the teenagers in that section of the camp said, you know something? They're going to kill us anyway. Let's take matter into our own hands. Let's kill ourselves. And all the teenagers line up behind the Russians, patiently waiting for their dose of poison, including Elie Wiesel, who told her, I fully intended to make that my last day on Earth. I was going to take that rat poison. Says, we're waiting, and your father, the chassid, retained his faith even there. And before we got to our place in line, before any of the teenagers got to their place in line, your father goes off to the side of the line and breaks into the ancient Vishnitsa Nigan for an imamin b'amuna shlema b'viyas HaMashiach. I believe in ultimate redemption. And that song broke our suicidal spell. One by one, we left the line. One by one, we surrounded your father and joined him in singing Nani Maman. So let me pull together everything that we've talked about. Just touching on the surface of a little bit about the psychology of going through tough times in life. But we talked about this last point is the point of the multiplicity of coping rooms. Sometimes it's music, like the story I just told. Sometimes, for some people, it's distraction. For some people, it's writing. For some people, it's art. Everybody has to find their own toolbox of coping mechanisms and build up a toolbox. When we developed treatments for abused children, we would literally, very mindfully, show them an upsetting movie clip. Then we'd have them go to a table that had 13 coping mechanisms on the table, and they would experiment with different soothing mechanisms. And over the course of their therapy with us, they would build up, like literally, a bag of, it might have been music, it might have been lotions, it might have been perfumes. It was a bunch of things that they would carry around with them. And every kid was different. No two kids had the same toolbox of coping mechanisms. So that's the point of dealing with loss and suffering with the Kaylee, not Lama, but Lama. The next point we talked about was the power of meaning, the power of coming to some personal meaning in terms of what we were talking about in terms of Yod versus Goral, of going from a passive to an active position. And then the other point that we talked about was the part of meaning making about barrel versus flax and trying to understand how the only way to know what's going to be helpful to somebody you're trying to help is to ask them what might be helpful. and not to be afraid to ask them, do you want to talk about this? Do you want to, how could I be helpful to you? Do you want me to just hang out with you, or do you want to talk to me about what's going on in your head or in your heart? We talked about being stuck versus positioned. And ultimately, we talked also about Maggid. We're getting ready for Pesach. And the power of naming the monster, the power of going from Dmimus to Maggid, which is ultimately what Avelis is about, is going from the initial shock of a death, right? We're in a fascinating way that the first Yisrael says, an al tanachem chavercha b'shas mesam utalfanav. So he says a weird cryptic thing. He says he'll cry. And when he sees that you're not giving him nechama, he'll cry even more. Adaraba, he says, you'll cry even more because tears aren't bad. Tears are filled with stress hormones. Early on, you start that way, and then over time, sometimes over months or years, you get to the point of meaning. So that's just a little tasting of a little bit about what the Jewish perspectives are in this area. They're always dovetail beautifully with the psychological perspectives. But may we all be zocha as we start to go into preparation for Pesach to have the full understanding of Maggid, and may Maggid bring to anybody here who's going through loss or tough times in life, bring them the nechama that comes with words, understanding, meaning, and connection. Thank you.
So if anyone has any questions, they can around and speak, Dr. Pelkovitz. And keep your eyes out for the flyers and essays at all the events going on in Spotlight Week tomorrow night. Our lead tag's coming, which will be great. And then for the rest of the week, we'll be having more and more events. So just look out for those. Thank you again, Dr. Pelkovitz.
Thanks, thank you. Be well, everybody. Thank you.
You probably, listen, remember when I was like at the wedding and like my throat was killing me and I was like, I'm gonna throw up? I just wanted to be a psychologist.
Oh my god, amazing. I have to go, your flyers are in the office.
Great, yeah. So I'll get them tomorrow.
As of like 2 hours ago.
Fantastic.
Okay.
I will get them tomorrow morning.
Please text me.
I will. Thanks, UD. Yes, are we leave tag?
Yeah,
we will be. Okay. Yeah, it'll all be on Y-Torah. I mean, not like, it'll be right, on like a week or so. It'll be on Y-Torah.
I'm going to the Avodah HaKodesh.
Yeah.
But he was my teacher last year, and like, it would make my whole month here. And but like,
yeah, we will be recording this year tomorrow night also.
Thank you.